This is Healthcare Strategies.
This podcast was recorded remotely due to the coronavirus pandemic. As a result, the quality may be a little lower than our usual standards. We appreciate your patience as we practice social distancing. From all of us at Xtelligent Healthcare Media, stay healthy, stay safe, and enjoy the latest episode of Healthcare Strategies. Many of the pandemic challenges, such as emergency room overuse or avoidable readmissions, are directly affected by social determinants of health. To steer through the challenges, Vivify Health's remote patient monitoring platform manages patients with the utmost care and addresses social determinants of health. For screening, monitoring, and virtual care, reach out today at vivifyhealth.com.
Hello and welcome to Healthcare Strategies. I'm Emily Sokol, Senior Researcher and Editor at Xtelligent Healthcare Media. Today we are talking with Christina Severin, President and CEO of the Community Care Cooperative, an accountable care organization governed by federally qualified health centers in Massachusetts. Community Care Cooperative, or C3, was founded in 2016 by an initial group of 9 federally qualified health centers to respond to an innovative ACO program. Today, C3 has 19 FQHCs and is the largest Massachusetts ACO, taking on the full total cost of care risk. Their work has made progress towards the quadruple aim, decreasing avoidable costs, increasing health outcomes, improving patient experience, and increasing provider satisfaction. Today, we'll be talking with Christina about her organization's population health. Today, we will be talking with Christina about her organization's population health strategy and the role social determinants of health play in that strategy. Welcome, Christina.
I'm really pleased to be with you here today.
So I want to start by discussing C3's organizational model. I think it's pretty unique. You know, you're an accountable care organization made up of federally qualified health centers, or FQHCs. Can you give us an overview of your organization's model?
Yes, absolutely. We are unique. An overview of the organizational model is that we are an accountable care organization. That means that we take responsibility for managing a global budget for those members that we serve, and we are also responsible for the quality outcomes for those individuals. Our members get their care at any one of our 19 federally qualified health centers. Our federally qualified health centers are also capital M members of the C3 Corporation. C3 is a 501c3 nonprofit, as are all of these FQHCs. We currently have one ACO contract, and that contract is with Massachusetts Medicaid, which is locally called MassHealth. And we have 140,000 MassHealth beneficiaries who are members of our accountable care organization and receive their care at one of our 19 federally qualified health centers. We are the largest FQHC-based accountable care organization in the country that is organized to take so-called two-sided risk on total cost of care, which means that if we're successful in managing our budget, we get to keep a portion of the savings. And if we are unsuccessful in managing our budget, we need to get out our checkbook and write a check to state government to compensate for having not effectively managed our budget.
So one of the things that I want to sort of start with is being involved in a two-sided risk model. We often hear that large hospital systems or physician groups are able to take on these downside risk models because of their resources, whereas FQHCs, there's almost a stigma that they're traditionally underfunded. So I'm wondering how you were able to overcome the potential barriers or roadblocks to participate in these more advanced risk-based models.
It's a really good question. You know, the U.S. healthcare system is so ripe with paradoxes and ironies. And one of them is that the healthcare entities that historically have demonstrated the most economic success in delivering value. So, for example, delivering a basket of healthcare goods and services like primary care or total cost of care that is more economically efficient than other systems or other entities, historically have not been financially rewarded. In fact, the healthcare organizations that have historically produced economic efficiencies with the price of the bundle of goods they're serving and delivering have been undercompensated in the healthcare system. Federally qualified health centers are an example of this. To prove this, I would cite an article published in the American Journal of Public Health in November of 2016. In that article, the authors who published the study studied two cohorts of patients prospectively, longitudinally, over time. One of those cohorts of patients received their primary care in federally qualified health centers. The other cohort of patients received their care in any other type of primary care setting. And what they did is they studied the total cost of care of these two cohorts over time. And what they found is that the cohort of patients who received their care at federally qualified health centers had a total cost of care that was about 24% less expensive than the other cohort of people who received their care in any other type of primary care setting. The quality at the FQHCs was equal, if not better, than the other cohort. So that's an example of data supporting FQHC economic efficiency. The problem that FQHCs have had and other economically effective members of the healthcare ecosystem is that they were never set up to be the economic beneficiaries of their own economic effectiveness. So before ACO contracts, what those economics would mean is that if that FQHC had a contract with a major commercial carrier, that would be a profitable book of business for that carrier to have a contract with that FQHC. The FQHC wasn't holding on to that money to reinvest in their organization and supporting physician recruitment and retention and staff satisfaction and the public health mission of that health center and the community served by that health center, which probably is disproportionately a community living in color and based on the community served, a health center who is serving disproportionately people of color. The ACO environment, therefore, allows the health centers to hang on to that economic efficiency. That economic efficiency allows us as a group of health centers scaled together to effectively beat our ACO budget. That allows C3 as the entity that has the contract with Massachusetts Medicaid to beat the budget and then to return those savings to the participating federally qualified health centers for them to further invest in business operations and pursuit of their mission, vision, and goals.
So the ACO model is really helping you reap the benefits of all of the good work that you're doing.
Yes, absolutely. And it also allows us to break the power and value equation of large systems, sort of controlling all of the risk contracts and therefore controlling the money and controlling how the game gets played, if you will. We think that what we've done really allows health centers to break the mold of what they have done and what they can do. And not only be successful, but I think provide, in our case, an example to important stakeholders like state government, the Medicaid authority, that there's a different way to do business that is highly effective and highly responsive to the needs of Medicaid beneficiaries.
Absolutely. So in that vein, I want to get on the subject of the hour, which is population health. I know that it can be a kind of vague term. Population health management is something a lot of payers and provider organizations are really focusing on. But how do you define it?
Yeah,
was wondering if, to start, you can just lay the groundwork and define population health management.
It's very insightful of you to ask, I think. It's something I've thought a lot about over time from the time that the term first emerged. It is not exactly clear what people mean when they say population health. And I'll tell you that, particularly over the last several months with the racial justice movement in this country, that if I really think about population health as public health for the individuals that we serve. When you get down to the mechanics of, okay, someone's giving me a pop health definition, what does that really mean? Well, I think when you start thinking about public health, right, you start thinking about segmentation and stratification. So even if you think about something like the COVID pandemic, you want to make sure that everybody is okay. You want to work for a vaccine to ensure that people will be okay in the future. And you also want to identify people who are at high risk because of what they do for a living, who they work with, or other circumstances, maybe immunocompromised or have a chronic disease that put them at risk for an adverse outcome if they were to get COVID. That's sort of how we think about population health as public health at C3. So we look to stratify and segment so that we can understand different cohorts of individuals in order to deliver what is most clinically appropriate and promoting of health and wellness for individuals and therefore the population at large.
Absolutely. Can you dive a little bit more into C3's population health strategy? Particularly, you were talking about segmentation. So how do you go about segmenting populations and putting together efforts for these different populations?
Yeah. So the first thing that we have done is put together a very robust enterprise data warehouse, or EDW. And I'll explain for people who are not familiar with an EDW, I'm just going to talk this through. So as an ACO, we have many data assets that we want to collect and harness and normalize so that they can inform our population health efforts. So for example, in our EDW, we have all of our paid claims on our MassHealth beneficiaries. We have all of the clinical data on our members that we source out of the electronic health records used by all of our health centers. We have so-called ENS data, or electronic notification system. What that data is when a member shows up in an emergency department or in an inpatient setting, we get a little electronic ping that we call an ENS that tells us that the individual is in the emergency department, is being admitted to an inpatient facility, or transferred or discharged from a facility. We have all of those transactions in our enterprise data warehouse. We also have, we do universal screening on social determinants of health. We have those results in our enterprise data warehouse, and we also have member self-reported data about their health status. And so if you think about all of those things that I've listed as rivers, and that data is flowing through the rivers, and each river is a separate river. So claims data, paid claims data is a river. Clinical data through electronic health records is a data. ENS information is a river. And all of those rivers are flowing into one body of water. That body of water is the EDW. What the EDW then does, and we're lucky to work with a great population health vendor that houses all of this data and that puts together the logic for this data. And the logic, I like to explain it to people, like if we just had all of data running through the river and into the ocean, it might be hard to see through the water because data looks different coming from different places. For example, a body mass index, a BMI, in one health record might look different than how the data elements are put together in a different health record. And so what the Arcadia software does is it sort of normalizes and harmonizes all of the data and makes a very clear ocean. So if you were to walk into our EDW and you were looking for BMIs, regardless of which EHR product a health center was using, the data would be as clean, EHR product to EHR product, and highly usable for all population health functions. So first we build up all of the data as just described, and then we can say, okay, now we have all of this data, that's great, but how are we going to use it in an actionable manner? And so this is when we think about stratification and segmentation. For example, we think it's important to understand people who are patients, who are inpatient at an acute care facility, who are predicted to be likely to have a readmission. That allows us to deploy staff who can meet individuals' bedside work with the individual and their family, caregivers, and the team at the hospital to make an appropriate discharge plan and to ensure when that individual goes home that they have what they need to support them in that plan and to connect them back with their primary care provider and or specialist and get them any home-based services that they need. Another example would be predicting individuals who are at risk for an adverse health outcome in the near future, where an intervention would make a difference. When we do that segmentation and stratification, we run a program called Complex Care Management, which offers those individuals more customized support for their health and well-being, which could include social worker support, RN support, pharmacy support, and or community health worker support, of course, in addition to the engagement of their primary care team.
There's a lot there I want to come back to and unpack. The first thing that I want to talk about, Christina, is some of the challenges that might exist to data integration, because like you had said, a critical part of this is having that information in order to segment and set up the notification system and identify where need is. So I'm wondering, especially thinking about in the early days of rolling out population health management strategies, what some of the challenges you had to data integration and how you were able to overcome those challenges.
So some of those challenges in the initial years have to do with making sure that data integrity is very, very high. You know, again, our partners are definitely industry leaders in this. With that said, no software is a silver bullet for data integrity. So any ACO going into this should expect to expend a good amount of sweat equity in data validation and running diagnostics when something doesn't look right and doing a root cause analysis on chain of custody on the data element and finding out what the source of any errors might be and systematically correcting them. And although there is a lot of work up front, the work does not end. So for example, right, part of getting this right, particularly when you're using clinical data from the EHR, which is wonderfully robust and concurrent information, Arcadia is able to refresh our clinical data every night. Paid claims data is great. It's very tidy data. We get it once a month and it's lagged. Clinical data is very concurrent. It's also very complex. The EHRs are very complex. So the mapping, you know, that we worked with Arcadia on is very good. And you have to map all of those EHR elements you want from the EHR into the enterprise data warehouse. So you implement it, you know, you test it, you clean it, you test it, you call it darn good. And then you march forward. And then something happens like one of your health centers uses an EHR and the vendor does a software upgrade. And a couple of the elements in the data map break because they're now in a different place in the EHR. So then you have an aha moment and you say, okay, now we need to implement a process for EHR upgrade so that we can know in advance and understand what the release will contain, what the upgrade will contain, so that we can do any needed pre-work in expectation of this EHR upgrade happening so that we don't break anything that we have built in the past.
It sounds like communication with your FQHC partners is really critical in order to, you know, identify any changes that might have been made and sort of get champions on board as well to help with the process and put in that sweat equity.
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of thinking about new ways of doing business together that we might not have thought of. We're a young company. We put the company together in 2016, and we did a lot of thinking about the data assets that we wanted to leverage into the EDW so that we could successfully segment and stratify. But we hadn't gotten to think about, oh, and what happens when there's an EHR upgrade, and how do we build business processes and controls around that so that we don't stumble when it's time for an upgrade.
Right. So part of it was putting the systems in place at the beginning when you were setting up the company, but then part of it was also being flexible as you continued to grow and expand.
Yes, absolutely.
Great. So I want to harken back to something that you had said earlier about social determinants of health and your social determinants of health screening. Can you give me a sort of a brief overview of what that screening looks like? And then we'll dive into some of the elements.
For us, we use a social determinant of health screening tool. We did a modification off of the federal accountable health communities tool, and some of the questions included in our modified SDOH screening tool ask about housing stability, nutrition or food source stability. We ask questions about job and employment. We try to get at least one SDOH screen done on all of our members every year. The most common place for it to occur is in the course of a visit in a primary care setting at a health center. However, our transitions of care team also does social determinant of health screening, as does our complex care management team.
I've heard a lot from providers that one of the biggest challenges to addressing social determinants of health is the discomfort with even bringing up that conversation, particularly if they don't have resources to point patients to. So what strategies were you at C3 able to employ to help get providers on board with social determinants of health screening and be able to be comfortable talking through these conversations with their patients?
I think what you articulate is real. A disproportionate percent of individuals served at the health center are living in poverty, and poverty and racism are the two biggest social determinants of health that exist. For health centers to have been successful over the last few decades, they have already been in a space to have competencies in this area, including being able to live in the discomfort of asking the question, and a robust array of social service organizations that are also, like the health center, part of the fabric of the community that the health center has established relationships with. With that said, we have also made a lot of progress in building out what we have to offer on social determinant of health fulfillment or remediation. We use another software application. It is an SDOH platform that I think some people would describe as sort of like match.com. So if I'm a user of that tool and I've got a patient, I can go and put in the area I'm looking to search and what I'm looking to search, so for food, and the results that I get will be local sources to fulfill against that social determinant. In this example, it would be food pantries, for example. It's also crowdsourced, so that if I'm that food pantry and I know that we've just expanded our offering or opened a location or closed a location, I can update my information, and that information will update the OnFirtha knowledge base. Or if I'm a health center and I know that there's a new food pantry or one that has closed, I can also update that knowledge base so that the information is constantly being updated and refined by the user base of that software application. At C3, we also have a system that, thanks to the partnership with state government, can go one step further. And that program is called Flexible Services. And so if somebody meets program criteria, we can not only refer them to somewhere that can help them alleviate their social determinant, like referring them to a food pantry to help with hunger, but we can also give them some cash assistance to buy those groceries.
And having that database of community partners sounds instrumental in this response. I'm sitting here wondering, you know, very simplistically, why more organizations aren't using a tool or resources like that to connect and refer patients to community partners.
Well, it's a pretty new space. And I think that over the last couple of years, there's been pretty rapid adoption. My guess would be over the next couple of years, we'll see some of the big EHR vendors, perhaps the big population health vendors, look to start to incorporate these SDOH tools into core product offerings.
There's kind of a two-part challenge with addressing social determinants of health, in that you're trying to measure something that didn't happen, like this patient didn't get diabetes because they had access to healthier food options. And it's a longer-term measurement that might be hard to capture if patients are moving around, switching providers, et cetera. So I'm wondering, sort of what your thoughts are on the evidence base for social determinants of health and some of the tools or arguments that you have used when talking to partners or even providers to sort of make the case for addressing social determinants of health.
Starting with the end of your question, fortunately, working with federally qualified health centers and the clinicians who work at those health centers, there's no need to make a case on the importance of addressing social determinants. On the first part of your question, you're wondering about where's the evidence base. I think it partly depends on what your definition of social determinants of health are. So I just want to talk a little bit about that, right? We definitely differentiate between social determinants of health and health-related social needs. We consider social determinants of health to be largely driven by institutionalized racism and poverty. And those are separate and often related. Health-related social needs we consider to be needs that somebody has that is non-clinical, that is having a very profound impact on what is happening with them clinically. Let me give you a straightforward example. If we have a patient who is currently inpatient at a hospital and they have no home, it makes discharging the individual very, very difficult and makes the likelihood of that individual readmitting very high, right? And we try to address both social determinants and health-related social needs. Getting back to social determinants of health, I think that you are right in that if you were to Google sort of the return on investment of investing in social determinants of health, I do not think that you're going to find a lot of academic or scholarly research around the findings. However, if you took a public health view on the adverse impacts on chronic disease prevalence, morbidity, and life expectancy or mortality caused by living in poverty and or the experience of living with institutionalized racism, the findings are quite, quite clear. Here in the city of Boston, if you can compare zip codes of some of the poorest neighborhoods and where people of color live against some of the most affluent and disproportionately white zip codes in the city, life expectancy has a difference of 30 years. So the evidence is clear and compelling on the impacts of racism and poverty on people and their health.
One of the big topics I wanted to talk to you about was the role that social determinants of health and population health management can have in making care more equitable. So you touched on that a little bit, but can you dive a little bit deeper into some of the steps, both I think at an individual provider or maybe community organization that you're referring your patients to address some of these health-related social needs, as well as the role that FQHCs or ACOs and these advanced large health models can take in addressing some of these really upstream inequities?
One of the core assets that FQHCs have that have made them and continue to make them really exceptional in delivering care to underserved communities is that the individuals who work at the health center tend to look like the individuals who live in the community. Now, that's not true 100% of the time. In some of our communities that serve mostly people of color, I don't think that we can say that the number of PCPs who are people of color is exactly representational of the percent of people of color living in the community. However, they certainly have done a very good job promoting workforce diversity and inclusion. I think that we need to bring that FQHC model of inclusion and trust to more places within the healthcare ecosystem. COVID has had so many just painful examples of how the healthcare system does not effectively work for people of color and for people living in poverty in an equitable basis. Telehealth has had some very interesting lessons learned, I think, in terms of how it can be an asset in looking to further bridge these inequities and foster equity. But when we now rethink care because of the COVID pandemic, I think we can use the telehealth modalities to rebuild the system in a way that is more uniquely responsive to low-income communities and to people of color.
Christina, I've really enjoyed the conversation. I think it's a really, really important one. So I want to thank you very much for taking the time to have it with us today.
You're very welcome. It's been my pleasure speaking with you today.
And for our listeners, what tools are you implementing to address social determinants of health and care inequities? Tell us your thoughts by sharing this episode on Twitter and tagging HIT Analytics. Thanks.
Many of the pandemic challenges, such as emergency room overuse or avoidable readmissions, are directly affected by social determinants of health. To steer through the challenges, Vivify Health's remote patient monitoring platform manages patients with the utmost care and addresses social determinants of health. For screening, monitoring, and virtual care, reach out today at vivifyhealth.com.
This has been an Extelligent Healthcare Media production.